From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A wild ride on Wall Street and from markets around the world Monday, with the Dow dropping more than 1,000 points, or more than 5.5% of its total value, at the opening bell. After a rebound later in the morning, the Dow closed down at 15,874.29, losing 777.51 points, or 4.67% of value, from Friday's close at 16,459.75, which was in turn down 530.94 points from the prior day's closing. Before Monday's opening in New York, market closings brought ominous clouds across the globe as they moved westward from China, which saw markets lose more than 8%, wiping out all of the past year's gains, and across Europe, which saw losses ranging from 4 to 6% on average. The immediate cause of the collapse in U.S. markets that was most cited was the sell-off in China, which, after some of its top indices dropped 8% of their value, was followed by a domino effect, dragging down markets around the world. In Europe, London's FTSE finished the day down 4.67%, while markets in France and Germany ended the day down 5.5% and 4.96%, respectively. China's markets have been on a rough ride since mid-June. Victor Gao, director of the China National Association of International Studies, speaking with RT Monday, described the recent turmoil.
Ever since around June the 12th, the domestic Chinese stock market has taken a lot of plunge. And today, again, is a very tragic day for the investors on the Asia market. In China, the Shanghai index dropped to 3,200 or so, and this is about almost 40% drop from the peak, which was achieved in late May. So this was a very big shock to both institutional investors as well as retail investors. And this also indicates that there are significant weaknesses in the Chinese development. And this drop in recent weeks happened against the background of very strong government actions trying to prop up the stock market at about 4,000 points in the Shanghai index. So it's a disappointment as far as the government initiative to prop up the share prices are concerned. And also, this is a big disappointment to investors, especially retail investors, who originally thought that once the government started to intervene, the slide in the share prices in the Asia market will be stopped. So it's very alarming, and I think the government really need to, you know, look at the situation in a new way, and also institutional and retail investors also need to re-strategize as to what may come in the coming few days.
However, Gao said that China's basic economy is still growing and that investors should look to the long haul rather than chasing short-term gains in the midst of the current volatility.
First of all, it is a fact that the Chinese GDP growth has dropped from the highs of 11% to 12% to currently about 7%. And there are also beliefs that even at 7%, the real numbers may be even lower than the 7%. And however, in the medium and longer term, I'm very optimistic about the continuous momentum in the Chinese economic growth. Therefore, for example, in terms of the institutional and retail investors, rather than looking at the share prices on a daily basis, they can also take a longer-term view at the share performances in the Chinese domestic market, which eventually will reflect the pickup in the Chinese growth momentum. The Chinese central bank, the People's Bank of China, recently decided to depreciate the value of the renminbi against the dollar in particular. That hopefully will help the Chinese export in the short term. And in the longer term, of course, Chinese economy need to go through a very profound and sometimes very painful restructuring, move from labor-intensive production to more technology-intensive development model and also innovation driven, for example, from made in China to invented and patented in China, for example. However, this may take, you know, months, if not years, to really materialize.
Some experts, however, say the real problem isn't the recent sell-offs or the current domestic economy in China, but a set of fundamental problems in the U.S., European, and Japanese economies that are structural in nature and have been a long time in the making. Among those experts is Dr. Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and visiting professor at the New School in New York. We spoke with him via Skype Monday. So, a wild day on Wall Street and markets around the world, and it's been kind of a weird ride over the last week or two with no one knowing really where it's going to end up. Can you help contextualize this for us a little bit?
Sure. It's hard to know where to start in explaining this. So let's go back to the beginning. Capitalism as a system, 200 to 300 years old, starting in England in the 18th century, spreading to Europe, North America, Japan, and basically now global. Over that period of time, this has been perhaps the most unstable economic system the world has ever seen. Every 3 to 7 years, there's an economic downturn. Sometimes they're short and shallow, other times they're long and deep. Long and deep ones that are notable, the 1930s, the one in the middle of the 1970s, and now the one since 2008. Everything has been tried. Every government policy, every private adjustment, every legal change to cope with, to stop, to even just moderate these cycles. Nothing has worked. Nothing has been found to deal with this problem. And I suspect that's simply because in order to get rid of the instability, you'd have to get rid of the system itself and replace it with something else. And most of the time, the people in charge consider that an unacceptable line of inquiry, let alone a line of policy. So on one level, nobody should be surprised. This is how capitalism works. Having said that, there are two things that have happened more recently to explain this one. The first is that starting in the 1970s, a massive abandonment by capitalists, major corporations, of the places they had grown up in, Western Europe, North America, and Japan, moving production more and more to India, China, Brazil, places like that. And in the process, moving from high wages to low wages, making a ton of profits. And when you make a ton of profits, and the reason for that is simple, you replaced high-cost workers with low-cost workers. Everything else, roughly speaking, stayed the same. With the explosion of profits, that money went into buying shares, because if you own shares of a company, you get a piece of the profits that flow from moving from high to low wage locuses of production. So we had a boom in the stock market basically for the last 30 or 40 years, granted ups and downs, but basically despite the ups and downs, a boom period. No way could that last. And all that we're seeing now is the somewhat delayed, but in the line of the higher they are, the harder they fall. The longer the stock market had this artificial boom based on cheap wages, the more we knew, those of us who pay attention to this, that when the corrections come, like in 2008 and now this week, they will be brutal because they have to correct for the out of whackedness, if I can use that term, of the way this system works. And the last thing is China, because it's getting so much attention. The truth is more than it ought to. But there is, of course, a grain of truth in it. China made a decision 20 years ago to go the capitalist route. They invited capitalist corporations from around the world in, and they came by the thousands. And they also made their economy export dependent. That means production depends on selling goods made in China to capitalist economies in Western Europe, North America, Japan, and so on. What that meant is that China was signing on to a fundamentally unstable capitalism and is now having the economic downturn that goes with that. And when you factor that in to the movement from higher to lower wages, you have this artificial boom, would have come to crash sooner, but with the injection of unprecedented amounts of new money into the economy by the Federal Reserve here, by the European Central Bank, by the Japanese Bank, you've kept this artificially pumped up economic system up a few more years. But all that does is mean that when the carnage hits, as it has last week and again today, it's going to be brutal. And if we come out of it, last point, if we come out of it and it turns up again this week, since nothing fundamental has changed, hold on to your hat, because all of these gyrations are part of the way this unstable system works.
Okay, so we're looking at the macro view of what's happening right now. And to get to the fundamentals, the capitalism, the crisis, the periodic crisis that it has is generally looked at as a crisis of oversupply. In the old days, people had no refrigerator. You start producing refrigerators. Pretty soon you're producing them so efficiently that you make more refrigerators than people need. Now nobody buys refrigerators and you have a collapse.
Right.
So you have that going on first, but all of that presupposed that up to the point of collapse that people who needed refrigerators could afford refrigerators. You've had a massive change in the status of what was the most prosperous consumer society in the world, the United States, with the transfer of the jobs out of this country and for a long while supplying refrigerators to the Chinese people who had no refrigerators and to everyone else in the world, including replacing our refrigerators more cheaply than they could be produced here. Where are we at now as far as that goes?
Again, it's a typical story. You're absolutely right. When the momentum to invest in foreign countries really got underway, and that's the 1970s, partly because the jet engine comes into a play at that time, and you can now get to any corner of the world to mind your business in a matter of hours. And then with the telecommunications, the internet, you can install a camera in a factory 10,000 miles away and be as on top of what's going on as you used to be when the factory was across the street. So you had this massive movement to the wonders of China, a well-educated, well-trained, well-disciplined, and unspeakably cheap labor force. And so, of course, because that's how capitalism works, every company had to go in there. Everyone had to close shop where they were and open a new factory in Shanghai, Guangdong, or any of the other major industrial areas. There's no logic to this. There's no planning. That's a bad word in capitalism. And so it's literally inevitable that in the rush to be the competitive one getting in there, you end up, in the language of economics, producing more capacity than you have demand for because there's too many competing companies. None of them dares hold back because they'll be left out of this cheap labor stampede. So they all rush in. And here we are, 2015. And if you look at what has happened, the capacity to produce has gone way bonkers ahead of absorption. For example, in the auto industry, we now estimate that we have 50 to 75% greater capacity to produce automobiles around the world than we have any basis for imagining the purchasing power there to buy them. Then it's only a question of which car company goes belly up in what order, because you can't sustain the irrational investment. And then when you add, as you rightly do, that the standard of living, the wages of workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan are going down, well, then you have an even worse situation because you're undercutting the demand in large parts of the world, even as you increase the supply and giving refrigerators and cars to the Chinese, while it is certainly part of this story, absolutely cannot, because of their low wages, cannot pick up what is being lost in the West, and the result is the kind of chaos now reflected in the stock market.
Okay, so there's some real economy things, and then there's finance that gets introduced into this. As the United States working class grew more prosperous, relatively speaking, in the post-war period up through the 60s, maybe mid-late 60s, there was a development of a middle class that actually accumulated wealth in the form of home ownership, savings, bond holdings, and such. And as the wages started to drop, beginning in the mid-late 70s, early 80s, you started to see easy finance that was used in place of wages to continue the acquisition of goods or the purchase of goods and preventing an oversupply crisis. Those have been exhausted pretty much now. How does that impact things?
Well, it's again, it's like I said before, you had since 2008 for sure a pumping in of the money supply to keep the happy times of the stock market mumbling along as they did. If you go back to the 70s, then that's right, consumer credit kept up the demand. It was a way of kind of deluding the public, and unfortunately it deluded way more economists than it should have, into thinking that, well, since people were consuming a lot, it didn't matter that the basis of their consumption was more and more debt rather than a rising wage, which had been the basis of rising consumption in America before that. So if you look at the long span, since the 1970s, consumer demand is based on debt. And since 2008, everybody else's demand is based on funny money pumped into the economy by the monetary authorities. Then again, you get this clear image of a system that is on life support, but imagines it isn't. And all of that heavy oxygen coming in through the tubes is not an artificial sustenance, which it turns out, of course, that it was. And here's another double irony. If you make few people very, very rich, and the average middle disappears, and everybody else is scrambling to stay afloat, especially with debt, it's only a matter of time before the rich discover that if you impoverish the mass of people, it's going to come back, that reality, and bite you in the rear end sooner or later. We depend on each other in these modern societies, no matter how much pretense we have of going it alone and being the individual who survives. It doesn't work that way. The people who own the shares are today losing trillions of dollars, and one basic reason is that they've impoverished the mass of their fellow citizens to make them unable to buy what the companies are selling in whom they own shares. It's a kind of chickens coming home to roost in a frightening way.
You know, the Reagan administration came in. This was being advocated before Reagan, but the Reagan administration came in and began to seriously implement almost an anti-Roosevelt program where they used stimulus, but the stimulus was related to debt, and the nature of the debt changed from consumer debt to home mortgages, which is where a tremendous amount of wealth in the hands of the middle class used to rest. And that has been mostly metabolized now. So how can they pump money into the system at this point without directly employing people, or can they?
They can't, and they know that. The people who work around the Federal Reserve are very freaked out by what's going on because of the conservative Republican Party control of the Congress. You can't have an aggressive fiscal policy. That is when the government spends a great deal of money beyond what it takes in to kind of pump the economy up. And so everything depends on money. They have already pumped unprecedented, that is, we've never seen this in American history, the period of the last 5 or 10 years of how much money has been pumped into the economy. The anxiety that that could one day start running after goods and services and land and assets and produce the inflation of all time, that fear lies behind the anxiety of being more aggressive with the financial pumping of more money. So they don't want to go in that direction. They can't get the government to stimulate. That's why there's this crash in part in Wall Street, that everybody who's in the business sees that the headwinds are very strong and the tools with which to handle them have been steadily either overused or removed from the realm of political possibility. And that means you're facing risks of systemic breakdown. And the minute you start thinking like that, all these investors start heading for the hills, and then you see the kinds of shock and panic that we saw at the end of last week and that have resumed this morning.
In 2008, you saw something similar to what's happening now take place in the markets, and you had warning of the preconditions at that time, people that were looking anyway, had warning of the preconditions of that time, which have matured over the last, 7 years or whatever. One thing that happened, you had banks heavily invested in the stock market and in all kinds of other instruments, including particularly mortgages. And as those investments went bad, the banks collapsed, and ultimately a couple of $1 trillion, depending on whose number you use, was given to the banks from the public treasury to sustain them, and insurance companies as well, like AIG. We may be looking at that crisis again, either the next few days or perhaps the next time this happens. Can that be done?
Same problem. It can be done, but you're adding more trouble to an already troubled economy, more support, more subsidy, and the resources for doing that are limited, and the capacity of the economy to work like that is limited. The idea of raising the interest rates, which was supposed to happen this summer, then it was supposed to happen in September, that was always in question because of the terrible fear that since everybody is now indebted up to their eyebrows, every government, every company, every consumer, that if you make credit more expensive, which is what raising the interest rate does, who knows how that will spin out of control. We've never had the average American family carrying debt that is larger than its annual income. We didn't have anything like that in the Great Depression, and yet we had a horrific depression. We don't have any basis for being sure that the next one wouldn't even be worse because there's such an enormous debt overhang. Last thing, when the prime mortgage collapsed, the subprime mortgages, and by the way, the prime ones too, in 2008, then the investment community, the banks who had to try to figure out a way to make money, started investing heavily in third world countries, getting involved in China and all the production of goods and commodities around the world that would be fed into the Chinese industrial machine to produce the goods that were coming here. Now they're caught in the overinvestment that has to do with the overproduction of the excessing of supply relative to demand in this unregulated, chaotic system. And they're in trouble again. And the question is, can they go to the government if things really get bad and get another bailout? I don't think that will be an available option for them politically. I just don't think that they can do that kind of thing because it's the politically impossible thing. You basically now had a quote-unquote recovery that bypassed most Americans, for example, only really helping the rich. They watched the collapse caused by what the rich were speculating in. Then they watched the government bail out the rich, just as you described it. They didn't get any of it. And you're going to go back to them now and say, they messed up again, and so we're going to have to take your money and impose a greater austerity on you to free up the resources to help these people out. you're beginning to look at a system that is exhausting its tolerability in the mass of the people. And that brings us to a whole new level of our history than most people in this country dare to confront.
But while the market volatility seems to be hurting people across the world, there are some right here in the United States who have been suffering longer and more deeply. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford filed this commentary.
For generations, it's been an article of faith among black people that education is the path to success, not just for the individual, but for the black community as a whole. That's never been entirely true, which is why W.E.B. Du Bois was the first black person to get a Ph.D. from Harvard, but was not allowed to teach there, and why black high schools in Washington, D.C. during Jim Crow were full of teachers with doctorates who couldn't find steady employment elsewhere. The notion that college is the great equalizer in American society may have some validity for whites and Asian Americans, but for Hispanics and blacks, the situation is much more complicated. A new study by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis finds that the wealth of black families headed by college graduates diminished dramatically between 1992 and 2013. There were three recessions over that time period, but despite the downturns, the median net worth or wealth of white households headed by a college graduate increased by 86%. For Asian college families, the rise in net worth was even more dramatic. Over the two decades, their wealth went up nearly 90%. But black families in which the head of household held a college degree saw their net worth drop by more than half, 56% when adjusted for inflation. In other words, three recessions in 20 years didn't stop whites and Asian American college graduates from steadily increasing their family wealth, while black college families saw a steady erosion of their economic status. Hispanic households headed by college graduates lost a catastrophic 72% of their wealth in the last recession alone, largely because they were even more heavily invested in housing than their black counterparts. Indeed, black college graduate households lost a lot more during the recessions than black families headed by people without college degrees, whose wealth declined less than 4%. But of course, that's largely because most black people don't have much wealth to lose. After the last recession, black median household wealth shrank to 1/20th that of white families. Black college households, along with their Hispanic peers, sank a lot more of their money into the family home, where much of it disappeared in the Great Recession. The homes of white college graduates declined in value by only 25% during the economic meltdown, but black and Hispanic college graduates' homes lost about half their value. The authors of the study conclude that the black and Hispanic college families fared so badly during the recessions because they were deeper in debt, both on their houses and their college educations. Without the benefit of affluent relatives and in a job market rife with racism, their college degrees provided little protection from economic downturns. The study states the obvious, that higher education alone cannot level the playing field. But a report by the Federal Reserve Bank cannot tell the real truth. That it is statistically impossible for blacks under the current system to ever achieve economic parity with whites, no matter what their educations. What's needed is a fundamental transformation of society, a revolution. Let that be a lesson to you. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.